We'll make a start of poetry, see how we get on, and we'll take a break shortly here. So, how do you read poetry? Now, there's some similarities between Hebrew. Most of the poetry in the Bible was originally written in Hebrew. Okay, it's translated into English, but there's very little poetry in the New Testament. Most of it's in the Old Testament, and the Old Testament is originally written in Hebrew. So when we're talking about poetry, I'm primarily talking about how poetry works in Hebrew. And there's some similarities with poems that we know. Okay, so as in English poems, Hebrew poems do a lot with imagery. Okay, so God is a rock, or God, we hide under his wings, or the floods are rising and they're rising up to our necks and we need to have a fortress to cling to. Those are poetic images that you get, say, in the Psalms, for instance, that we sort of intuitively get how that works, I think, as in that, you know, imagery works similarly in English poetry. So I won't really belabor that. I think you probably already have that figured out. But there's a second aspect of Hebrew poetry that is kind of different for us, and this is the kind of basic building blocks of Hebrew poetry, is something called parallelism. In Hebrew, it's really easy to, because of the way Hebrew words are constructed, you can just add endings to words, depending on the role it plays in a sentence. And that means it's really easy to add the same ending to a word in Hebrew, which would mean it would be really easy to make words rhyme in Hebrew. So Hebrew poems don't work on rhyming like they do in English. So in English, a lot of our poems have to do with words that rhyme. It doesn't work that way in Hebrew because that would be like cheating. It'd be too easy for the Hebrew poets. So they need a more complex way of doing poetic stuff. So instead of rhyming, what they use is what's called parallelism. Parallelism, as the term suggests, is two lines that are parallel in some way, although the term is a bit misleading in that the lines are never completely exactly identical. They're sort of parallel and making a parallel point. You can have two parallel ideas within a couple lines or between two lines. And the parallel could be in terms of the actual sort of kind of verb, sort of the grammar or the sounds that the words are making. But most obviously to us in English would be the actual meanings of words themselves. So let me just give you an example here. And you get Hebrew poetry, especially in the Psalms, the most obvious place to look, but also a lot of the prophets write in sort of a Hebrew poetic way. So this is actually from a passage from Isaiah. And you've got the text on your handout if you want to have a look there as well. But Isaiah 1 verse 3, an ox knows his master and an ass its master's trough. Israel does not know, my people does not understand. Now what we have here are two sets of two parallel lines. See, the first one here, an ox knows his master and an ass its master's trough. Those sound quite similar, don't they? But they're not exactly the same. So we've got an ox is parallel with an ass. Nose is implied here. And his master's trough. Okay, so we've got two sort of parallel lines. And then we've got another two parallel lines down here. Israel does not know, my people does not understand. So Israel, my people, does not know, does not understand. Okay, you see that? The parallelism can be where the same idea is repeated exactly the same, or it can be like contrasting. So what we have, this is kind of interesting example, because we've got two sets of parallels, one here and one here, but actually both of them are actually contrasting with each other, right? So the point that Isaiah is making here is, okay, an ox knows his master, an ass knows where to go to eat. But by contrast, my people are so dull that they don't even know who I am. Like, they don't know me. So there's a contrast being made between stupid donkeys and cows and my people who should know better. Okay? So there's parallelism happening at two levels here, within these two lines and between these two sets of lines. So these ones are kind of synonymous and parallel, and these are like contrasting. You see how that whole thing works? Now, one other aspect of parallelism is that typically the second line, it doesn't just repeat the idea in the first line, but it advances the idea in some way. That's what scholars call seconding. So the second line kind of pushes forward the idea a little bit more. It's like we're pressing into it a bit further, accenting it a little bit more. You can see this here. An ox knows its master. The oxes are reasonably, I mean, compared to asses, they're reasonably intelligent, and they know who their masters are. But the point here is that this second line even makes the point more extremely. Okay, an ox knows his master. Well, even a donkey knows, even if he doesn't know who his master is, at least he knows where to go to get the slop. Okay? So it's pushing the idea a little bit more, advancing the idea a little bit further. Same here. Israel doesn't know. It's not just some generic people. It's my people. Okay, this is there's more like emotion behind this one. Not just Israel, but my people, God says, do not understand. Okay, so the second line pushes even more deeply into the idea introduced in the first line. This is how all of Hebrew poetry is built on this system of parallel lines. Have you ever had the experience of reading through the psalm and it's just like, you just said that, fella. Like, there's a lot of repetition. Like, every other line is like, do we need this one? Let's chuck it. Like, we could distill this psalm down into like three basic points. I'm trying to get a three-point sermon out of this thing and you keep repeating yourself. I'll just cut out every other line. It'll be a lot simpler. Well, that's not how Hebrew poetry works. This is how it works. And if you appreciate that actually the second line is actually pushing, advancing the idea a little bit further, what you have here, the two parallel lines are kind of like the fact that we've got two eyes that kind of helps to get a kind of a focus on an issue. All right, so this slightly different perspective from two eyes that working together helps us with our clarity of vision. So kind of like it's bifocal vision with these two lines, two angles looking at the same thing, either from contrasting vantage points or from the same vantage point. Does that make sense? So that maybe helps to make sense of why the Psalms are so repetitive, because that's how Hebrew poetry works. And your English translators, they actually try to help you with this, in that most English Bibles actually lay out poetry in, you can see the sort of, there'll be like couplets, like lines set off in pairs or in threes or something. There'll be a little space between lines. Have you ever noticed that? How like the actual layout in your Bibles in the Psalms is different than, say, in the book of Acts? That's the translators trying to clue you in to the fact that these are supposed to go together. So there's some help that they're trying to give you with that. That's why there's some spaces between bits and some lines are grouped together. Those are parallel lines in Hebrew. So let's look just briefly at a second example. You've got on your handout there Psalm 57, which we've got some parallelism here, and we've also got imagery, just symbolic imagery. So you see the first couple lines there in Psalm 57, I cry to God Most High, to God who fulfills His purpose for me. Okay, so the first line, and then that second line is repeating that same idea, but it's pressing a little more deeply into it. I cry to God Most High, not just to any God, but to the God who will fulfill His purpose for me. So that makes sense why I'm calling to Him, because He's the God who will fulfill His purpose for me. So the second line actually advances the idea a little bit in some way. And then you see the second, the next three lines are actually go together as a triplet, sort of three parallel lines. You can have that, sort of either they come in doublets or triplets. He will send from heaven and save me. He will put to shame those who trample me. God will send forth His steadfast love and His faithfulness. Okay, so you see the first line and the third line are really similar. You see the idea of God sending in both lines. He will send from heaven and save me in the first line. And the third line, God will send forth, not just like God will just send, but He presses more deeply into that idea. God will send His steadfast love and faithfulness. So it's advancing the idea there. And the middle line is kind of the inverse of that. So it's a kind of a contrasting point. God will put to shame those who trample me. So that's the negative effect on other people and the positive effect on the psalmist. Right? So God will save me and He'll put them to shame. So, but all three of them work together as they're three angles on the same phenomenon. God's same activity, same action. Does that make sense? Then the next stanza here. I lie down among lions that greedily devour prey. Their teeth are spears and arrows. Their tongues are sharp swords. So you see the last two lines there are parallel lines. Teeth are spears, tongues are sharp swords. So those are kind of two angles, just capturing aspects of the enemies of the psalmist here. And notice how the psalmist uses imagery here. It's poetic imagery. So he says, I'm lying down among lions. Now, we know intuitively this is a poem, so it's not really like he's really literally among lions. It's not Daniel in the lion's den. He's surrounded by enemies, right? But he depicts his enemies as lions. And then once he's got the image of a lion in his head, he works with that image. Oh, what do lions have that make them dangerous? Teeth, tongues. So he says, well, their teeth are spears and arrows. Well, that's a kind of a natural link to make, because we're actually talking about an army on the run chasing David down while he's running for his life from Saul. So he likens his enemies to lions, and their teeth are like spears and arrows, and their tongues are sharp swords. Okay, so you see the imagery working together with the parallel lines there, capturing an aspect of David's experience. We have lions overhead at the moment. So, little ones, lion cubs. Okay, let me finish this off. A couple more comments just to make about poetry, and then we'll take a break. So that's how Hebrew poetry works. And as I said, you find it mostly in the Psalms. You also find it, say, in Lamentations or big chunks of the prophets. Within the Psalms, there are different kinds of psalms. Psalms that are focused on different sorts of themes. And I've listed for you sort of five major categories of psalms and just listed a few examples of different examples of the different kinds. So we have psalms that are kind of focused on God's law or on wisdom. In the context of worship, so Psalm 1, Psalm 119 are examples of that. And those psalms like that, I think, highlight how you cannot separate worship from obedience to God's law. Those things go hand in hand for the psalmist. We have royal psalms. So these are psalms that originally were written to celebrate when the Davidic king would be sitting on the throne to celebrate his reign. But what's interesting is that because although a lot of the individual psalms were written, you know, during David's own lifetime or in the years after that, the book of Psalms as a whole wasn't put together as a final book until Israel is in exile. We know that because there are some psalms in the book of Psalms that are written by people in exile. Take Psalm 137, I think, by the waters of Babylon, we sat and wept. Remember that psalm? The Babylonians were in captivity, and they're asking us to sing the songs of Zion, but how can we sing the songs of Zion when, you know, Jerusalem's destroyed and we're in captivity? So that psalm is obviously written when they're in exile. So the book as a whole wasn't finally gathered together and put together until after the whole dynasty of the Davidic kings had collapsed. Which makes it really interesting that they chose to include these psalms that are about the Davidic king, like Psalm 2, in which God says, you know, the nations conspire and they plot together and they laugh saying, ha ha ha, but I don't scoff at me, because I have installed on Zion my king. Today, I have made him my son, God says in Psalm chapter 2. Now, he's just talking about either David or a son of David, one of David's descendants who sat on the throne. But the Israelites, when they are finishing up compiling the book of Psalms, they chose to keep that one in their psalter when there were no kings sitting on the throne. The last king had gone into exile. Zedekiah gets his eyes poked out, you know, at the end of 2 Kings. It's a bit of a rum luck for him. Why do they keep these royal psalms in the psalter? Because God made a promise to King David that you will always have a son sitting on the throne. That's 2 Samuel chapter 7. There's a covenant that was made to David. So the Israelites believe God actually is somehow going to keep this promise. So there's going to be a descendant of David one day who's going to sit on the throne. So we're going to keep singing these songs about the Davidic king because we're expecting one to come. So you have this growing, rising sense of expectation for a descendant of David, a Messiah, which is the English translation of Mashiach, which is a Hebrew word that just means anointed one. That's what Messiah means, anointed one. So they're waiting for the king. So we got wisdom psalms, we have royal psalms. Which, of course, by the way, the New Testament authors find some matches between some of those royal psalms and somebody that we know and love very well. Right? Some of those psalms get quoted all over the New Testament. Psalm 2, Psalm 110, Psalm 118. It's not a royal psalm, but it features the temple. And they apply these psalms to Jesus in various ways. So we've got wisdom psalms, royal psalms, psalms of lament. Now, these are psalms written by people who are angry, or they are doubting, or they are anxious, or they are broken. They're psalms that have lines like, "How long, O Lord, will you reject me forever? Will you hide your face from me forever? God, where are you? Why have you not done anything about my enemies? I wish you'd break their teeth. They've done so many terrible things to me." Psalms that just cry out to God from a place of brokenness and longing and a sense of injustice. And did you know that probably a third of the psalms in the book of Psalms are lament psalms? It's a huge chunk. A huge chunk of the psalms are songs of lament, of lamenting, of crying. We can learn something about that. I guess something quite beautiful about that. Because the psalms are prayers and praise to God, right? But they're in the Bible, which means they're also in some way God's word to us. So try to fit that together. How are prayers to God also God's word to us? I think in this case, in the case of the Lament Psalms, is God's way of saying, here's where to take your brokenness. I want to hear it. Cry out to me. Be honest with me. Even be angry with me if you're feeling hard done by or unjustly treated. Cry out, lament, even if it feels like I'm distant. There's something very wholesome about crying out to God, where are you? Because in doing that, I'm actively searching for God, right? God, where are you? Why aren't you here? But I'm actually talking to him, so he's there, right? So the lament psalms are invitations to be honest with God. So wisdom, royal, lament psalms, pilgrimage psalms, these are psalms that the Israelites would sing when they're on the way to Jerusalem to have a feast or a festival. They're songs of ascent. And they're called songs of ascent because to get to Jerusalem from anywhere else in Israel, you've got to go uphill. So they're going uphill, they're walking uphill, and they're singing these songs, songs of ascent, as they ascend to Jerusalem to go to, maybe they're going to the Passover or something. And they sing these songs of praise as they're delighting and anticipating going into the temple and meeting with God and having their sins covered and atoned for through the sacrifices and that sort of thing. And then we have songs of praise and thanksgiving that give language to a whole bunch of our hymns and choruses that we sing. A lot of them are generated by lines from the Psalms, so that's familiar territory to us. Okay, so maybe that gets you some few pointers on reading Hebrew poetry. Any questions or comments on any of that? All right, why don't we take a break? Let's take 15 minutes. There's lots of delightful snacks and drinks over there, so help yourself, and we'll reconvene in 15 minutes.
What's up? what we're saying to the people. He's patient, but he's sort of recognizes this is kind of the way that the world's here, and protected. He's going to change the truth for everything right away, but he's working on the
Tiberius was the next one. Thank you.
of different.
It's like a bear? That's a leaf.
Okay, you'll make a start in about 30 seconds or so. Okay, can we make a start? We've all watered and fed.